Hello and welcome to the Deathcast Early Bird Ad and Bullshit Free Version, where this week we are taking our fifth look at the Texas Killing Field murders. Before we get going, as always, a shout out to Channel and Anthony, the first two Patreon supporters, as well as a shout out to the largest contributors monthly, Samantha, Debbie, Becky, and Matt. Rock on, all of you, my D&Ders. I greatly appreciate your support. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last episode, we had reached the end of the 1980s with the sporadic spate of killings that had taken place throughout the decade, seemingly having come to a close. On September 8th of 1991, an individual was out in the Calder Road field when they came across a badly decomposed set of human remains. The police were contacted. They collected the body. It would not be until 2019 when this victim was identified as 34-year-old Donna Marie Prudhomme of Nassau Bay, Texas. There's not a ton of information out there concerning Donna Marie. We know that she was born in Port Arthur, Texas in 1957, that she had lived in Beaumont, Texas, and Austin around 1986, before heading to Seabrook and lastly to Nassau Bay, where it's believed she had moved for job opportunities. Some sources state that Donna moved frequently in an attempt to escape a violent relationship and that she had two children. These same sources state that it was uncharacteristic of her to be out of contact with her children for any length of time. There are conflicting reports as to whether or not Donna was actually listed as a missing person, with some stating that family members had been searching for her from around 1989, and that family members had been working with DNA specialists prior to her identification in 2019. Other sources have it that there was no missing persons report ever given on Donna. Now, sometime prior to her being found deceased, Donna was arrested. However, we do not know the specifics of this arrest, only that it had happened and that at the time she was identified, police decided to use the mugshot they had of her to give people an idea of what she had most recently looked like prior to her disappearance. In addition to this, we really don't know specifics about her death. We know that Donna frequented bars around Nassau. We do not know her work history in the area. There is some speculation she may have been working to support a drug habit. However, I've found nothing that either confirms or denies that. Now, people initially tried to lump Donna, who at the time was known as Janet Doe, in with the three original killings that had been discovered in Calder Road. However, police did state pretty emphatically that while the first three victims found in the mid to late 1980s were all posed in a similar fashion, Donna's body was not found in a similar state, leading them to speculate that it was more likely than not that Donna had been killed by a different perpetrator than the initial three victims. Additionally, There are stories out there stating that she had died from strangulation. However, I could find no concrete evidence of this in any police reports. And I believe more likely than not that this is speculation on the part of armchair sleuths on the internet. The next set of killings that are linked to the Texas killing fields do not take place until 1996. So again, we have a long period of time in between crimes that are being put into this category of Texas killing field murders. That is not to say that no other crimes took place during this period of time, only that for some arbitrary reason, people within the media and or law enforcement decided to put these victims on this list together in a similar fashion to what was done with the Atlanta Child Murders list, where many victims who died during that period of time were simply decided not to be involved and were therefore excluded from the list, meaning that police did not put forth the effort to solve those crimes. In this case, however, especially from the 1980s onward, it does appear as though police were putting in the effort to try and solve these crimes. Now, this crime is different from almost all of the other crimes, save for one, in that it involves two African-American girls. That would be Lynette Bibbs, aged 14, and Tamara Fisher, aged 15. On February 1st, 1996, the two girls went to a Houston club for teenagers. Now, some sources state that the two girls were last seen at a motel located on Old Spanish Trail. This comes from a 22-year-old male who said that he dropped the girls off at this location. However, from what I could gather online, there's no definitive evidence that that actually took place, nor is there any evidence, or so it appears, of the police having vetted this individual as possibly being connected to the girls' disappearances. From what I could find, he seems to be the last person to have seen either girl alive. Now, we do know that their bodies were found on February 3rd, 1996. Their bodies were discovered on a rural road near Cleveland, Texas, which is just outside of Houston, still in the Houston metropolitan area. According to police reports, both girls had been shot to death. However, as different caliber bullets were recovered from the bodies, police speculate that more than one assailant was involved. The next victim that we're going to discuss is a 13-year-old by the name of Crystal Jean Baker, who was last seen on March 5th, 1996 in Texas City. Crystal was the third of four children with an older brother and sister. Now, by the time that Crystal had turned 13, there had been some problems in her school. Crystal's parents got divorced when she was very young. Her mother ends up moving to Dixon, which is right near Texas City. According to Crystal's mother, during that school year, she had been called in for a conference with the principal as her daughter, who had begun to develop, had been targeted by other girls in her grade who had not begun to develop, and these girls had been bullying her. Her mother recounted a story where these girls had cornered her in a park and assaulted her. This led to Crystal's mother reaching out to her mother, who lived in Texas City, and asking if Crystal could come and live with her for the remainder of the school year. This would place Crystal into a different school district, thus keeping her away from these girls. Now, according to her mother, this was not something that Crystal was happy about, as she did not want to leave her friends, but being as she's 13 years old, she has very little say in the matter, so it's off to Grandma's house that she goes. On the morning of March 5th, Crystal contacts her mother complaining of an ear infection, and her mother tells her to stay in bed. She will arrange a doctor's appointment. After getting off the phone with her mother, Crystal then contacts her dad, explaining that she's stayed home for the day because of an ear infection, but she left her shoes at her friend's house, and she asks her father if he'll give her a ride over there so that she can pick her shoes up. Her father, who had just gotten home from work, explained that he couldn't, and that was the end of the matter. However, later that day, Crystal and her grandmother, who got home from work somewhere between 1 and 2, had an argument. The grandmother was upset that Crystal had stayed home from school and refused to drive her to her friend's house to get the shoes. Eventually, this leads to the two of them standing outside in the driveway where the argument continues before Crystal eventually storms off in anger. Her grandmother last saw her heading south on Pecan Drive towards Texas Avenue, which is a main thoroughfare. At this point, Crystal's grandmother goes inside the house, contacts the Texas City Police Department, explains the situation, and asks for officers to find her granddaughter and bring her back to the house. So about a block, give or take, from her grandmother's home, Crystal comes upon a tire store. She goes inside and asks if she can use their phone. The workers inside agree. She calls her mother, asking if her mother will come and get her. Her mother informs her that she cannot do so at that point, as the mother, whose name is Jeannie, worked as a hairdresser and was extremely busy during that time. So instead, Crystal's mom tells her to go back to her grandmother's house, clear the air with her grandmother, and that she, the mother, will make the doctor's appointment and pick her up later that afternoon. After hanging up, however, Crystal makes a number of calls, to the point that one of the workers at the store let her know that, hey, this is a business phone and you can't use it all day. Upon leaving the tire store, instead of heading back to her grandmother's house, Crystal heads east along Texas Avenue. As this is going on at roughly the same time, the police have arrived at Crystal's grandmother's house, where the grandmother is again explaining the situation, that she didn't have permission to leave the house, and the officer agreed to go and look for Crystal. Not long after this, the officer returns back to Crystal's grandmother's house and informs her that he was unable to find her granddaughter. What we know: around 3 o'clock, Crystal's mother, Jeannie, called her mother and let her know that she had a doctor's appointment scheduled for Crystal, only to learn that Crystal had not returned to the house. According to Jeannie, she contacted a number of Crystal's friends throughout the afternoon, as well as the Texas City Police. However, none of them had seen her, and the police informed her that she will probably return by later that afternoon. When she gets off work, Jeannie calls her mother, only to learn that her daughter has not returned home, nor has she gone to her father's house. Jeannie then drives to the home of the friend Crystal had wanted to see, only to learn that Crystal is not there. At this point, Jeannie ends up driving to Galveston. in the hopes that maybe her daughter has been able to get a ride out there. Unfortunately, however, Crystal is unable to be located. At some point after Jeannie returns home, Crystal's boyfriend Randall shows up at the house looking for her. And according to Jeannie, it was at this point that she began to really understand that something was seriously wrong. Contacting the Texas City Police again, she is pretty much brushed off. At some point around 5 p.m. that evening, the Chambers County Sheriff's Department received a phone call. A couple had been out fishing in Anahawk, which is roughly 74 miles northeast of Texas City, when they had come upon the nude body of a young girl lying on the ground beneath Trinity River. I-10 crosses over at this point, and according to police reports, it appeared that somebody had thrown the girl's body from the overpass down into the riverbed below. This couple had covered the body with a white sheet and a blouse. Upon removing the sheet, it was discovered that the girl was lying on her stomach, while the dress that she was wearing had been pulled up above her waist. There was no sign of shoes anywhere present. It was apparent to the officer on the scene that the girl had been beaten quite extensively. There were numerous cuts and bruises covering her body, as well as a dark purplish-red mark around her neck. Eventually, the body is going to be ordered sent to Houston, which is the largest metropolitan area near the town, where an autopsy is going to be performed the next day, March 6th. That same evening, Crystal's mother, Jeannie, is finally able to file a missing persons report with the Texas City Police Department, where Crystal is listed as a runaway. Now, from this autopsy, it's learned that the victim had been sexually assaulted, and the medical examiner noted that blood vessels had burst inside the girl's eyes, eyelids, and across her face, indicating that she had died from suffocation, which is eventually going to be ruled via strangulation. It's interesting to note that while the Chambers County Sheriff's Department sent out emails, which were in existence at this point in 1996, including to Texas City, they received no information concerning the Jane Doe that had been shipped off to Houston. And many have speculated that the reason that the body wasn't quickly identified as belonging to Crystal is because Crystal had been listed as a runaway. Now, as hard as it may be to believe or fathom this, things like that simply had a way of slipping through the cracks back then, just as it can in this day and age where, you know, everybody and everything is connected to one another. You know, human error can overlook something as simple as a body being found that matches the description of an individual who has gone missing from your jurisdiction. We know that during this point in time, Crystal's mother, Jeannie, found that her daughter had gone to the tire store, used the phone, and that she, her ex-husband, as well as her mother and other family members, continuously looked for Crystal. On March 21st, 1996, somebody who worked at the Texas City Police Department noticed the report that had come out of Chambers County concerning the Jane Doe. After a detective from Chambers County comes to Texas City and goes over everything with the officers, it's very quickly deduced that the Jane Doe is in fact Crystal Jean Baker. Crystal's mother, Jean goes and identifies her daughter. Texas City begins their investigation, while Chambers County, which has all of the personal effects that had been found on Crystal's body, begins to try and track down any sort of evidence that might lead them to the killer. However, it's going to be over a decade before this cold case is eventually solved. A woman by the name of Sherry Wilcox, who worked at the Chambers County Sheriff's Department, worked as an evidence officer. As she later stated in interviews, the pictures of the crime scene, the pictures of Crystal's body, were burned into her memory. According to Miss Wilcox, around 2002, she got a request from a private investigator who Crystal's mother had hired to look into the case. This PI wanted a copy of the file. According to Wilcox, at the time that Crystal went missing and was later found dead, she was in school, and she remembered vividly the discovery of the body in the local press, as well as her mother cautioning her concerning what could happen if she strayed away from those that she knew. Wilcox said that after sending a copy to the private investigator, she kept the file on her desk. Sherry said that one day, as she was looking through the file, she noticed a stain on Crystal's underwear and wondered whether or not anyone had ever tested this particular stain. According to Wilcox, after reading the lab report, she learned that the dress that Crystal had been wearing, as well as her undergarments, had been processed, but that no evidence was discovered. However, between 1996 and 2002, as most people who listen to this show are aware, DNA evidence made massive leaps and bounds in terms of evolution. After learning that the dress and undergarments were in fact still stored in the evidence locker, Wilcox filled out the correct forms and brought it to the Houston lab where it was to be processed, only to be told that it could no longer be tested as it had already been tested once. Obviously, this knocked the wind out of Wilcox's sails. However, she was not yet ready to give up. And in 2005, when the detective who had originally worked the case, Brad Moon, returned to the Chambers County Sheriff's Department, he and Wilcox began discussing the case. And it wasn't until 2009 when it's actually tested. And Wilcox does something kinda underhanded, but given the circumstances, understandable. She's assigned to go and bring evidence back to this Houston lab for testing. Before she leaves, however, she takes Crystal's dress and underwear and places them inside of a new envelope that doesn't have any markings on it, indicating that it has already been tested, writing on the form that she wanted them to check for bodily fluids and the presence of any type of DNA. Wilcox later said, "I didn't ask if we could, I just did it." Wilcox confides to Detective Moon what she has done, and they wait for the lab results. At the lab, semen stains are found around the collar of Crystal's dress. In August of 2009, Wilcox gets a phone call from the lab letting her know that they have a DNA profile match on the stains discovered on Crystal's dress. Now, a few days after this, both Wilcox and Moon drove to Dixon, Texas, where they met with Crystal's mother and father and told them about the new developments in the case. After obtaining DNA evidence from her parents, which was used to exclude either of them as well as Crystal from being the source of this DNA, and while they have this DNA evidence, they have no one that they're able to link it to. So as they are meandering their way forward, Wilcox and Moon decide that they need to see if the fingernail scrapings taken from Crystal are still held in the evidence freezer. And as luck would have it, they were. This revealed that semen was, in fact, under Crystal's fingernails, yielding still more DNA evidence. Years prior to all of this, the Chambers County Sheriff's Department had sent a copy of Crystal Baker's police report to the Behavioral Sciences Unit in Quantico, the FBI, you know, world-renowned unit. And the report that they came back with, the profile that they gave on the killer, was of a white male, aged 25 to 45 years old, who was a serial murderer. We've talked about in the past my views on the profiling techniques of the FBI and how, despite what the media would have you believe, more often than not, they're way the fuck off the mark on the things that they put. On occasion, they will get certain aspects right, but the reality is that is the exception to the rule. And I say this because the DNA profile that they get back is not for a white male. It is for an African-American male. Something else that the FBI, in their grandiosity, thought wasn't possible, as for decades they stated that the majority of serial offenders were in fact white males. In recent years, it has been proven conclusively that this is in fact not the case, and that more African-American males are in fact serial killers than white males are. So with all of this information, Wilcox submits this piece of DNA evidence into the CODIS, which is a U.S. government-run combined DNA index system. Basically, it's what they use to try and link convicted felons to various crimes, to try and identify missing persons and individuals found to have died whose identification cannot be established. On September 15th of that year, 2009, Wilcox gets a phone call stating that they had a match to the DNA she had entered into the CODIS system. Now, the individual who the DNA was linked to came to be in the CODIS system in a rather unique way. In 2010, he had been pulled over in Louisiana for a traffic violation, and during this stop, it was discovered that he had drugs in the car. Now, in Texas, they only collect DNA from those convicted of murder and sexual assaults, whereas in Louisiana, anyone who is convicted of a felony is subject to having their DNA taken. This individual was named Kevin Edison Smith, who'd had numerous brushes with the law, but nothing really serious. Smith, the oldest of four children, had been raised by his mother and his aunt, and had grown up in various small towns up and down the I-45 corridor, with the majority of that time spent in and around Texas City. Smith had been married three times previously and had lived all over the state of Texas working as a pipe welder. He was currently residing in Port Arthur, Texas, working as a pipe welder. So contacting the Texas Rangers, the Chambers County Police were able to get a search warrant for Smith's cell phone, which is how they were able to track him down. And eventually, the Texas Rangers move in and arrest Smith. Ironically, on Smith's 45th birthday of September 22nd, Smith, who was at work that day, had no idea that law enforcement was closing in on him. At some point during the day, he is called into his supervisor's office only to find Detective Moon and Wilcox waiting for him. As Smith entered the office, he was immediately read his rights and placed under arrest. When Smith attempted to protest his innocence, one of the Texas Rangers who was on scene stepped in and informed him that his DNA had been found on her clothing as well as on her body. According to Detective Moon, that based on the way Smith was acting, how nonchalant he was about the entire situation, he knew in his heart that they had found the right man. Back in Chambers County, Smith is brought before a judge who places his bail at $1 million. Evidence that's later going to be brought up at trial is the fact that the bruising around Crystal's neck was thicker on the left side than on the right side, and as Smith was left-handed, it stands to reason that his left hand would be the dominant hand and thus exert more force. Now, on the day Smith is arrested, he's behind bars. Sherry Wilcox and Detective Bradley Moon drive to Crystal's mother's house and inform her that the man believed to have murdered her daughter has been identified and arrested. In a strange twist of fate, the head of the new Black Panther Party, based out of Houston, Texas, a man by the name of Quinnell X, drove to the Chambers County Police Department and spoke with Smith. And what he later said was that he informed Smith that if he's being mistreated in jail, he'll fight for him. However, if he's guilty of this crime and lies about it, cries racism where none exists, it was going to backfire on all of them. Quinnell said that he told Smith that there was a second DNA test being run at that time to verify the results of the first test. Quinnell later said that as the conversation progressed, he point blank asked Smith, quote, "Do you think your DNA is going to be found in other cases?" To which Smith reportedly said, "I don't know." That's not the kind of reassurance that anyone wants to get from a man confused of raping and murdering a 13-year-old girl. As that statement right there leaves open the possibility that Kevin Smith almost certainly has committed other crimes of this nature, be it in Texas or in Louisiana. Quinnell said that the biggest concern that Smith had during this conversation was whether or not he was going to get the death penalty. Quinnell said that if Smith wanted it, he would talk to the district attorney on his behalf, seeing if they could get the death penalty removed as a possible option. Were Smith willing to confess to the murder of Crystal and provide police with all of the details? Later that afternoon, in Detective Moon's office, Quinnell met with the district attorney as well as Officer Moon, and he told them that he had explained to Smith that the offer he was trying to broker between him and the district attorney's office only concerned the case of Crystal Jean Baker. The district attorney would later state that she was not surprised to learn that there was the possibility, in fact the probability, that there were other cases that would eventually be linked to Smith. Later in the afternoon, in a conference room, Detective Moon, Evidence Officer Wilcock, the District Attorney, Kevin Smith, and Quinnell X sat down to talk. And at the beginning of the meeting, Quinnell explained exactly what it was that Kevin Smith wanted. The removal of the death penalty from his case should he confess to having committed the murder. After considering this for a few minutes, the district attorney agreed to waive the death penalty should Kevin Smith truthfully admit to his involvement in the murder of Crystal Jean Baker, for going on to explain that this waiver of the death penalty was only in connection with the murder of Crystal. To ensure that Kevin Smith understood exactly what was being said to him, Quinnell X explained again to him that if any other bodies are discovered with your DNA on them, then the district attorney's office will have nothing to do with whether or not the death penalty is involved in those cases. After this, Quinnell tries to set the stage, putting some of the blame off of Smith by explaining that at the point in time that Smith was going to be talking about 1996, he was struggling deeply with an addiction to alcohol, which I'm sorry, to me, is a complete cop-out. Quinnell said, quote, "Brother Kevin is not an evil man, a loving family, a wife. He was wrapped up in his own personal demons back then as far as drinking alcohol." At this point, the district attorney let it be known in no uncertain terms that she didn't give a fuck why any of this had happened, that there are no do-overs in life when things of this nature are concerned, and that no matter what happens, Smith will never get out of prison. At this point, everyone from law enforcement side leaves the conference room to allow Quinnell and Smith to talk. Eventually, Smith agrees to tell them what happened, his accounting of Crystal's last day on Earth. Now, according to Smith, on the day that Crystal went missing, he had been working at the Amoco plant located in Texas City. He had gotten off work and was at a nearby convenience store drinking with some of his co-workers, located on Texas Avenue. According to Smith, during this period of time, he was in the habit of getting drunk and then going out cruising for prostitutes. According to Smith, as he sat outside this convenience store having a cigarette and drinking a beer, quote, "I saw a girl walking down the highway," unquote. At this point, Smith went into the store, bought another beer, and then left in his Chevy extended cab pickup truck. He quickly caught up to the girl, pulled alongside her, and rolled down the window, where he began talking to her, offering her a ride. Now, according to Smith, Crystal willingly got into his truck and told him that she was 18 years old. Smith said that he believed that Crystal was working as a prostitute, and that he began talking to her about performing oral sex on him. Now, I'm not saying that this conversation didn't happen, but I smell bullshit. And I say that because oftentimes killers will try and mitigate their responsibility for a crime by casting aspersions on a victim, trying to paint them in the most negative light as humanly possible, as though what happened to them wasn't just the fault of the killer, but was also the fault of the victim for the lifestyle they chose, or for putting themselves into the situation that allowed the killer to have access to and take their life. Smith told the officers that Crystal informed him that she wasn't looking for sex, but was instead trying to get a ride to her friend's house. He stated that it didn't really matter to him what she said she wanted. He had already decided that he was going to have sex with her. He said that he drove for a short distance before pulling behind a gas station and offering her money, and that Crystal had refused his advances. We don't know exactly what happened. Smith said that Crystal suddenly started freaking out and hitting him, kicking him, and that he attempted to restrain her, eventually choking her to death. The truth of the matter is more probably that Smith attempted to forcibly rape Crystal, and that she fought back against him, and that during the course of all this, she died. Although I have to believe that the reality of the situation was more along the lines of he raped her and then killed her after realizing that he's gonna get caught for this crime. The DA wasn't stupid, however. She informed Smith that she had read the autopsy report and that in this report it stated that Crystal had died from ligature strangulation. And it's at this point that Smith states that, quote unquote, "I had like a strap I kept in my truck." At one point during the interview, Smith tried to completely shift the blame onto Crystal, stating that "I was just playing and she went berserk." He went on to say that if she had simply given in to his demands and allowed him to have sex with her, she would not have died. And before recounting how he had driven almost 60 miles to the overpass bridge where he dumped Crystal's body, when questioned why he had picked this location, Smith said that he had simply driven around until he found an area that seemed suitable for getting rid of her body, where no one would see him, as it seemed like a lonely place. While Smith did not admit during this interview to having raped Crystal, he did tell the police the one thing that they needed him to admit, that during the course of fondling and masturbating over her, he had in fact taken Crystal Jean Baker's life. Now, not long after this interview, a woman came forward claiming to have been Smith's first girlfriend, and the story she told police was that Smith and another man had raped her at gunpoint when she was a teenager, after which he had proceeded to stalk the young girl, killing her dog, making threats on her life and on the lives of her family members in an effort to keep her quiet. As things begin to move forward now that Smith has confessed, law enforcement across the state of Texas and into Louisiana look to see if they have any crimes committed in a similar fashion to the murder of Crystal Jean Baker. Perhaps realizing that there's a real good possibility that he's going to be slammed for a lot more than just this single murder, Kevin Smith attempts to retract all of the statements that he made to law enforcement on the day of his arrest, stating that Quinnell X had intimidated him in order to get him to admit guilt. However, these cries of coercion were ignored by both the police and the media. We do know that Detective Moon attempted to talk to Kevin Smith while he was incarcerated at the Chambers County Jail concerning other murders that had taken place in the area, specifically other cases involving the Texas Killing Fields. However, Kevin Smith insisted he had nothing to do with any of the murders, not even that of Crystal. One recorded jailhouse conversation with a relative has this relative wondering why Kevin is going to end up in prison for life for simply murdering a teenage girl. with this individual stating that they believe that 7 years would be more than enough. In 2012, the trial for Kevin Edison Smith in the murder of Crystal Jean Baker began. During testimony before the jury, Bradley Moon, the detective who had discovered Crystal's body, helped lay out a picture of what authorities thought had happened when Crystal's body was discovered. That Smith had driven to the area where her body was found and simply kicked her out of the car, leaving her there. Which I believe is possible. However, ever since I learned about this case and of the location of Crystal's body, I've always felt suspicious about it, thinking that there is a possibility that her body had in fact been dropped from the overpass above, given the amount of bruising that was on her body. That's not to say it's not possible that Smith didn't kick her out of the car and had in fact beaten her pretty savagely prior to and during the course of raping and murdering her. Moon also discussed briefly the evidence collected that night from Crystal's body and the chain of events that led to her autopsy the next day, and how the DNA evidence was tested, but unfortunately, nothing could be gleaned at that time in 1996. The defense then began to question Moon and basically focused their attempts on trying to prove that a lot of evidence from this case was actually missing. After this, a lot of the testimony concerned whether or not Smith had been made aware of his rights at the time of his arrest, during the time that he had been officially charged by the judge, and when he had given his confession. This was done because the defense was trying to get that confession thrown out as admissible in a court of law. Unfortunately for them, however, all of those who testified on behalf of the prosecution concerning the reading of rights and letting Kevin Smith know that he had a right to remain silent and to having an attorney present stated rather emphatically that they had in fact followed proper protocol. The prosecution asked a member of the Texas Rangers who had assisted in tracking down and arresting Kevin Smith about the truck he had been driving in 1996, as there was a possibility that it may still have contained evidence linking him to Crystal Smith's murder. You'll note that no mention was made of other possible crimes, as that could prejudice the jury. The member of the Texas Rangers stated that although they attempted to locate this vehicle, they were unable to do so. After which the prosecution went back to going over the DNA evidence, eventually leading up to how Kevin Smith's DNA was linked to being that which was found on Crystal's dress and underneath her fingernails, a point which I might add indicates that Crystal was still alive after Smith had ejaculated, although we don't know for a fact that he did not abuse her more than once. After Miss Wilcox testified about how she had gotten the DNA retested, the judge called a sidebar, as one of the alternate jurors had encountered Crystal's mother in the bathroom. Now, you're scratching your head wondering why this was the case. This was an old courthouse. It had one set of restrooms, so pretty much everyone used them. After this encounter, the juror had immediately gone up to the bailiff and informed them of what had happened, telling them that Jean had shown her a picture of Crystal after identifying herself. In the end, the juror was brought into the judge's chamber where they recounted the story, and she was dismissed from the trial, but only after the judge had questioned all of the other jurors about this incident, if they knew anything about it, if this juror had said anything to them about it. When they learned that this juror had not, the trial then resumed. Next up was a medical examiner from the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office who had reviewed Crystal's autopsy report. As he spoke, graphic pictures of Crystal's lifeless body and all the various wounds that she had suffered were shown to the jury. This doctor pretty much said that Crystal had died a slow, agonizing death. That the strap that used around her throat, most likely a welder's belt, was tightened around her throat, then released, tightened, and then released. Stating that the abrasion on the left side of her throat was due to the fact that the killer was left-handed and had come at her from the left side rear. The bruising on Crystal's body, it was said, could have been caused by being beaten, while the various abrasions may have been the result of either being thrown from the truck or thrown down to the ground below from the overpass above. Concerning a tear that had been found on Crystal's vagina, the physician stated that it had come from a blunt instrument, of which a penis or a finger could both be considered to have been that blunt instrument, and that the injury had actually occurred within an hour of Crystal's death, meaning that that particular aspect of the assault took place after Crystal was already dead. So Kevin Smith either digitally penetrated Crystal after she died, or he committed an act of necrophilia. The defense brought up some questions for this physician, particularly concerning the dirt that was found on Crystal's knees, which this physician conceded could have been the result of Smith taking her from the truck and out into a field where he may have, in fact, assaulted her and killed her. It is very possible that Smith removed her from the truck, assaulted her somewhere, brought her back into the truck, and continued the assault later. I would hazard to guess that he may have used this belt that he had strangled her with almost like a leash, just based on the ferocity of the attack that was perpetrated against Crystal. Quinnell X then took the stand where he affirmed that he had been talking to Smith at the behest of the family. He was not there in the form of a minister, but was there as an activist. Quinnell stated pretty emphatically on the stand, quote, "If this were a case where they picked the nearest brother they could find and threw everything at him, including the kitchen sink, if I believed he was innocent, I was about to stand with this brother all the way." Quinnell then stated that this was not the case and that Smith had admitted his guilt to him. Before going on to state some of the other things I have already told you that Quinnell said Smith told him. The prosecution then brought up the fact that the Smith family had paid Quinnell X $2,500 to look into the case. Quinnell admitted to having been paid this money, but stated that he had never promised the family that he would come back with a conclusion that Smith was, in fact, not guilty. After this, Detective Moon once again took the stand and recounted for the jurors the confession that Kevin Smith had provided to law enforcement, after which the prosecution rested its case. The defense opened up by reaffirming some things that Kevin Smith had claimed during his confession, that he believed Crystal was 18 years of age, that she had willingly gotten to his truck, and that the killing had not been planned but had instead been accidental. The defense called a single witness, a member of the Texas City Police, who stated that Crystal's death devastated the entire community of Texas City. After which, the defense asked for a sidebar with the judge, at which point the jury was removed from the courtroom, and the defense spoke to the judge concerning the possibility of Kevin Smith testifying. Smith had been flip-flopping during the entire proceedings as to whether or not he would testify in his own defense. Eventually, however, when the judge pressed him for a final answer, Smith declined to testify, after which point the defense rested its case. Both the prosecution and the defense then gave their closing arguments. He was charged with capital murder with aggravating circumstances, namely aggravated sexual assault of a child. During the prosecution's closing argument, he said one of the things that is most pertinent in these types of case. Quote, "What kind of person blames the victim for their own death?" The prosecution then went on to discuss the injuries that Crystal had on her body. It was their contention that she had not voluntarily gotten into Smith's truck, that they believed Smith had used the strap that he carried with him in the truck to drag Crystal Smith into the truck, and that this was the reason dirt had been found on Crystal's knees. At this point, everyone in the courtroom could hear Kevin Smith mumbling to himself from the defense table, quote, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it like that. I didn't do it like he said I did." Not long after this, the prosecution rested their final argument, and the judge, having given the jury their final instructions, sent them off to reach their verdict. After 45 minutes of deliberation, Kevin Edward Smith was found guilty of capital murder with aggravating circumstances and thus is in prison for the remainder of his life with no possibility of parole. After the trial had officially ended, the judge singled out Sherry Wilcox and stated, "That woman right there solved this. If she hadn't done it, this man would still be on the streets." We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope you have enjoyed our fifth look at the Texas killing fields. We'll be back next week where we'll take another look at these series of horrific murders. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid!